So good evening, everyone, and welcome to our sixth and final class, Megillat Rut, the fabulous Book of Ruth. Let's just contextualize a little of the history. So Ruth converts, comes back to live in Bethlehem of Judah. She goes out to gather food for sustenance for her and her former mother-in-law, Naomi. She meets on a fateful day Boaz, the potential redeemer. Boaz offers her comfort and support in his field. He says, do not go anywhere else. A reluctant Ruth accepts it. Once she realizes there's a mutuality to their relationship, goes back home, tells Naomi about this fabulous meeting. Naomi's excited. And then Naomi says, well, you need to do something because Boaz potentially could be a redeemer. Unbeknownst to Ruth, she didn't realize that Boaz was related to Naomi. What happens is, of course, Ruth goes back to the field. Barley season, wheat season, all the seasons pass. Boaz doesn't make a move, doesn't approach Ruth again. Now, how could he, we said? He's an 80-year-old octogenarian. She's this beautiful 40-year-old young lady from Moab. So how is he supposed to engage with her? How is he supposed to sort of take her out to Starbucks for coffee? It's awkward to say the least. He's the Gadol Ador, the giant rabbi of that generation, the shofet, the judge of the people. How is he supposed to even ask her out on a date? It seems highly, highly problematic from Boaz's point of view. So much so that after the barley and wheat seasons have come to their conclusion, Naomi is concerned because she thinks to herself, oh my gosh, you know, if during the whole time that you're in his field, daily he could see you, he knows where to find you. But now you're going to be totally off of Boaz's radar. We need to take steps to see what will be. And she asks of Ruth something stunning to totally make herself absolutely vulnerable and to give up herself, her own identity. She says, go down tonight. Boaz will be in the Goren, in the granary tonight. He's going to be watching for monkey business. People are corrupt. They may steal. There may be people who work for him that are going to be involved in an inappropriate behavior. He's going to be spending the night there. You need to go down there tonight, and you need to force the issue, Ruth. You need to go to him. You're going to uncover his feet, which are going to show him, Boaz, that either he should do Levirate marriage, marry you, do Yivam, or the opposite of Yivam, which is signified by Chalitza, we take off the shoe. So you're going to be saying to him, ostensibly, one or the other, you're a potential redeemer for myself, for my dead husband Mahlon, for Naomi's family, for her fields, for everything. You could do this, or not. So we say that she listens to everything her mother-in-law said. So much so that we have this fascinating word, a lie, to me. It's about me. Which at the very top of the page that we're on, which is Perek Gimel, the third chapter, verse number, number five, it says, Vatomer Eleha. So Ruth responds to Naomi and says to her, Kol, everything, Asher Tomri, that you say, E'eseh, I shall do. But there's a word missing there. It's not written in the text, but we read it into the text as part of the law of Moses from Sinai. We call it a Masorah, a tradition, that we have to add the word a lie. But yet it doesn't physically appear written there. So it is not written, but it's read traditionally. Now why is that? Because it's not about Ruth. Because the nature of Levirate marriage, we said, is that you are giving life to the dead. And ostensibly, Ruth is going to be the surrogate, if you will, for Naomi and her vision to rebuild her family. She's lost her husband Elimelech. She's lost her two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. And therefore, Ruth says it's not a problem. I will do this, even though it may be against my seichel, my logic dictates maybe I shouldn't do this. It's a tremendous risk. It's an exposure of the most profound way to go down, and it's very almost inappropriate to do this. Obviously, she's doing it. And we have to keep this in mind throughout the entire chapter. L'shem Shemayim, for the sake of heaven. In the same way that when Tamar dresses up and solicits Judah to have a child, it's not done in a pernicious thought, it's done to procreate and carry on the name of Judah, which, and that selflessness that Tamar had, is brought to bear with the selflessness of Ruth, and as we will see, the selflessness of Boaz himself. So that's where we left off tonight. Yes, Mr. Birnbaum.
Slightly off the subject. When did they start that you have to go to, like, she converted. Did she have to go to a Beis Din? Or when did they actually start a Beis Din?
Excellent. Excellent question. So the question is, in terms of Geirut, conversion, what would be a situation where you had to go in front of three rabbis, a panel of a Beit Din, and that happened much, much later in the process. Early on, the requirements that are written in Jewish law, even, for conversion, are not the same as they are today. Today, it's gotten much, much more difficult because of the nature of our world and how spread out. There, all the power was centrally located. So clearly, at the end of a process, it would have been ratified somewhere locally in Israel, because that's really all we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But later on, with the proliferation of other, shall we say, segments of Judaism and other denominations of Judaism, it became very difficult to keep control, and therefore the rabbis wanted to sort of have a bottom line expectation for conversion. But it's a much later process. In this situation, it's a good question. In this situation, would Ruth's conversion process, which was seemingly culminated in her relationship with Naomi, is that enough? Probably not. They don't say this, but the unspoken words would have been that it would have been ratified by Boaz himself. You can't go to a higher, and he's the Supreme Court judge, right? He is the head guy. So Boaz would have ratified that conversion. And remember, it's very difficult for rabbis today to know what is in a person's heart. We do the best we can. We can eliminate converts who are doing it for, shall we say, less than pure altruistic motives. So in Orthodoxy, we wouldn't want someone, you know, to do it for expedience sake. That we just don't like that. But on the other hand, it's entirely possible, and I'm sure it's happened hundreds and hundreds of times, where a person may be brought to Judaism through, let's say, a relationship with a Jewish boy or Jewish girl, but that at the end of the day, the relationship with a Jewish boy or girl is just the entree, the entry level, and that maybe that person, even after the relationship is consummated, maybe they don't even have a relationship with a Jewish boy or girl, but they are just absolutely in love with God and everything in Judaism. So it's really not for a rabbi or anyone of flesh and blood to decide your heart. All we can do is go from action. So it's a very sticky area. It's a controversial area, clearly in Israel today. There's much controversy with the way Israel accepts or does not accept rabbinical conversions from outside of Israel. It's a big area. So that's a discussion, maybe a class later on. And it's very germane, because that's the nature of Ruth and our whole approach, as we said, to why Ruth is there. Excellent question, Mr. Birnbaum. Thank you. Back inside the text then. So Pasuk Zion, number 7. Oh, it's been on the whole time. You're on the record. Yeah, I didn't shut it off at all. Zion, Perek Gimel, the 3rd chapter, 7th verse. So Vayochel Boaz eats, Vayesht, he consumes some alcohol, some wine, Vayitav Libo, his heart is merry. He's feeling good. Vayavo, and he comes, Lishkov, to lie down, Bitseha Arema, at the end of the big pile of grain in the granary. Vatavo Balat, she, Ruth, comes like a ninja, stealthily sneaks in. Vatigal Margilo Sav, she uncovers his feet. Vatishkov, and she lies down. Now, interesting, the rabbis contrast the idea that he eats and he's merry with his fidelity to not committing lewd acts, promiscuous acts. And they contrast this with another famous story of a great king, Ahasuerus, who on the 7th day of a great feast, he eats and he drinks and he's a little drunk, and then he starts to engage in a very highly sexualized discussion about women, so much so that he tells his own queen, Vashti, to come with nothing but the crown, naked. And I mean, it's the contrast, because here Boaz is absolutely scrupulous in his dedication to not letting his guard down in that area, because that's who Boaz is. And the rabbis contrast it with the illicit, horrible behavior of Ahasuerus, the way he treats Vashti, just the absolute mirror polar opposite situation. Okay, let's carry on. Now, poor Boaz has absolutely no idea what has just happened. It's dark. There's no light. And he's scared out of his mind. So the next verse says, Vayomer mi'at. Boaz says, who are you? He doesn't know who or what has just snuck up upon him. But Tomer, and she, Ruth, responds, Anochi Rut Amatecha. I am Ruth, your handmaiden. Ufarasta chenafecha alamatcha. Please spread your robe over your handmaid, your maidservant. Ki goel ata, because you are a redeemer to me. Stop. So lots of beautiful, beautiful words and allegories are going on here. First of all, he asked her who she is. So he's scared. That's very clear that he's very, very scared. How do we know he's scared? Because it's the middle of the night. There's no lighting, and she just comes, swoops down, vayilafet, she sneakily, stealthily comes and sits, you know, uncovers his feet, lies down right there, an inch away from him. He is really, really terrified. And it says later on that David HaMelech, King David, says that this is one of the moments that he blesses God, he blesses Boaz for not cursing whoever this person is, for scaring the life out of him. Because it says, Vayihi b'chatzi alayla. It was in the middle of the night. Jason is nodding very knowingly.
You see someone in the middle of the night, I'm sure you're going to see
absolutely, absolutely. And David says, thank God, had he cursed her, even one word negatively could have destroyed the relationship, could have destroyed Ruth, and there would be no me, says David. So thank you, God, for giving Boaz the wherewithal not to curse this young lady. Okay. Interestingly, we know, and we actually have a whole beautiful poem that would say, if you ever able to stay up that late on Passover and the Seder, by Yehiva Chatzi Alayla, and it happened in the middle of the night. We know that, for example, in the middle of the night, God comes down, strikes the Egyptians dead during the plague of the firstborn, but then it goes throughout history, all these wonderful, amazing things that happen b'chatzi halayla, in the middle of the night. And this is one of the this is one of those events that is, I'm not sure it's included there, but it is included by the rabbis in other areas, that this amazing idea, this birth, if you will, of the Messiah, of David, of Solomon, of Mashiach, all happens in the middle of the night. So he's startled. He says, who are you? She doesn't say, Ani Rut. She says, Anochi. Now, what's the difference? Well, Ani means I am. Anochi, as we've said in other classes, is an existential statement of being. This is who I am. I am Ruth, your handmaiden. She says, spread your wings, metaphorically, over me, because you're a redeemer. Marry me. Now, why the allegory of the wings? So they say that when birds mate, the male bird will take his wings and cover them so as to be tzaniot, to have modesty, so nobody watches them mating. So that's one of the allegories, that to spread the wings over your bride is to show this modesty. Okay, and we know, of course, that the idea of wings is also something we wish somebody when they pass to the next world, right? We say you should be tachas kanfei hashchinah. You should be under the protective cover of God's dominion. We have this famously in the Kelmale Rachamim that we recite at Yizkor on the memorial service. We say tachas kanfei hashchinah, right? The wings. And we know, so wings have a very powerful allegory, metaphor in Judaism. Now, what does she mean here? So, there's a lot of debate. Suffice it to say the following. In the law of Levirate marriage, if it was a conventional Levirate marriage, Abraham marries Sarah, Abraham tragically dies before they have a child, Isaac is told, marry your former sister-in-law, Sarah. Since Abraham, the dead spouse, had already done all the conventions of marriage, he had given her the ring or whatever it was, and they had the chuppah, they went through the whole process of a Jewish wedding, there already is a connection, we said, between Isaac, the younger brother, and his former sister-in-law, Sarah. So all that is necessary is to consummate the marriage. Now, when you consummate the marriage, it has to be done where there are witnesses, and you go into a room. They don't, obviously, they just close the door, but that is the consummation of the marriage. In other words, with Levirate marriage, you don't need to go through the whole rigmarole of the dating process and the kiddushin, which you give something of value. All that is not necessary. So here she's saying, essentially, that if you are a redeemer and you want to redeem me, we can immediately continue the process. Whether it was at that moment, I don't think she's asking. She's symbolizing to him, you need to take action. So let's see his response. Yud, number 10. Vayomer, and he says, Brucha at laHashem biti. You be blessed of God, my daughter. Hetaft, better. You have done much greater. Chastecha acharon, your latest kindness from the Rishon, from the earlier kindness. Levilti leches, for you have not gone after. Acharei habacharim, the young, handsome man. Imdal imashir, whether that young man is poor or whether he's wealthy. So, he is blown away. Boaz is thunderstruck. Oh my gosh. I mentioned to you in passing, I won't go into details, it's a little too graphic for the class, but Ruth was the most drop-dead gorgeous woman in the world. And anytime she walked into a room, she elicited a male response. That's the only way I can say
more
this.
More than Esther?
Well, Esther's was not as highly sexualized as Ruth's response. Without going into too much detail. It's not an issue of beauty necessarily. Like, you know, we talk about Esther's beauty and Rachel, our mother's beauty, and Sarah and Rebecca. It's not an issue of beauty. It's an issue more of response. She was very, very highly alluring. Okay? She was like the Marilyn Monroe on steroids. Okay? She elicited that type of male response. So he, Boaz, says, wait a minute. I'm this old guy. I'm not even sure, as we'll see in a minute, that I can even have children with you, that I'm even worthy of marrying you, because if I can't carry on the line, the whole point of us getting together is that you should have a child. But if I can't perform in that way, I'm not allowed to legally marry you. If you know that the husband in a Levirate marriage can't have children, then there's no Levirate marriage in that situation, because that's the whole modus operandi of the procedure here. Okay, so he is thunderstruck, because normally, if it's an old guy, you know, this old rich guy or this young, very attractive guy, whether he be rich or whether he be poor, usually the young lady is going to go after someone more her own age. So he says, the idea that you would even conceive of me as a husband is fantastic. But it's more than that. Without going into too much detail, again, it's a little bit too graphic. She's responding to him in a sexual way. And the idea in Boaz's mind that you can find me attractive is wow. And he says, the idea that you can see me, not just that we're mechanically going to have a child if we do get married, but that somehow I turn you on, is like amazing. So he says, this idea that you find me attractive, not just like this old guy that I have to sort of mechanically marry because it's my duty, that is like amazing. And this chesed, that is the kindness that he's referring to. Now, what's the earlier kindness? Well, the rabbis debate. The earlier kindness could be how you treated Mahlon and, you know, your late husband and didn't require money. How you stuck by Naomi all the way. Or how you accepted God into your heart and into your soul. But he's clearly talking about now the relationship. The latest kindness is her ability to see him as a mate, but in every sense of the word, which is stunning to Boaz. So then he carries on. How do I respond to you, he says. Va'ata, he says now, verse 11, Yud Aleph, Biti al tir'i, my daughter, don't be afraid, don't be worried. Kol asher tomri efzalach, for everything that you have spoken about, that I should marry you, I will do for you. I will do it. Ki yodea koshar ami, because everyone at the gates of my people, meaning the Sanhedrin who sat at the gates of the city, the court, highest court, no, that you are this fantastic woman of valor, you are the best, the ata ki amnam. But now we're in verse number 12. While it is true, ki, and now the next word is left out, it's written but not pronounced, we'll talk about that in a moment, ki im goel anochi, but we don't read it that way, we say ki goel anochi. While it's true that I am a potential redeemer, the Gam, however, also, Yesh Goel Karov Mimani, there's a Redeemer one step closer to you in the redemption line than me. Stop. So what is Boaz responding to? Now, she has made herself excruciatingly vulnerable and embarrassing herself. I mean, you can imagine coming to somebody, it's one thing to go to somebody and ask them on a date and they turn you down. This is like 100 steps beyond that, right? She's literally thrown herself at him and said, you know, marry me. And how do you turn her down gently. Now, what's the reluctance? What's the issue? The issue is the following, that there is one man named Tov who is a brother of Elimelech. And therefore, because Boaz is only the nephew, Tov is one step closer to the dead husband Mahlon in the pecking order of Levirate marriage. It is unfair, because the two, Tov doesn't even know that Ruth exists, and it's not going to be a comfort to Ruth that oh my gosh, there's someone else. She doesn't know this, but Boaz knows this, and he has to be the judge. So he says, look, my dear, I understand this is going to be hurtful to you. I want to do everything that you say, and God willing, I will. But you have to know that while I am in the redemption line, I'm number two. Tov is number one. We're going to meet Tov in the next chapter. Mr. Plony Almoni, Mr. So-and-so. That's going to be Tov, right? Now, why does it say that while everyone in the gate knows that, you know, you are an Eshechael, woman of elders, he's saying to her, there's no stigma here. I understand you're a Moabitess, and that it's only been now that we revitalize the idea that the stigma of the Moabite only applies to the men, not the women. But don't worry, because everyone at the Sanhedrin in the court, this is why it must be that just days before you came back into my life, we brought this issue up again and reintroduced this as a law from Sinai given to Moses that only Moabite men are disqualified, not women. So he's putting all the pieces together. And know that everyone understands this. There's no stigma at all. The problem is I can't marry you until Tov says yes or no. I can only marry you if Tov says no. We have to take that next step. But why do we leave out the word im in verse number 12? In other words, we read it, v'ata and now, ki amnam, while it is true, ki im goel anochi, that I am a redeemer. But why is the word im there? Why is he saying that if I am a redeemer, of course you're a redeemer. You're the nephew of Elimelech. Ah, that gets to potency. The im is written, but not said out loud. Why? Because that's what he thought. That if I can have children, I'm not sure, then I could be a redeemer. So the im is giving voice almost to the mind of Boaz, that he's worried. How can I be the Goel, the redeemer, if I can't fulfill my duty to give you a child? If I can't impregnate you, I can't marry you. So the im is the doubt, the lingering doubt in Boaz's mind about whether he qualifies on a halachic, on a Jewish law basis, to be the redeemer. He does. It's okay. But that's the im. That's why it's there as a ksiv, but not a kri. We don't read it that way. That's tradition. Again, we throw out the word. Okay? Next verse. Verse number 13. And this is one of the most magnificent verses, strangest verses in all of the book of Ruth. Okay? So what does he say to her? He says, Lini halayla. Stay the night. Sleep the night. Stay. Don't run away, please. Ruth, stay with me. V'hayava boker, and it shall be in the morning. Im yigalech tov yigal, that if in the morning time, if he, meaning tov, will redeem you, tov, good, he'll redeem you. V'im lo yachpots legalech, but if he doesn't want to redeem you, if tov, who becomes Mr. Anonymous, Mr. Plony Amoni, says, no, I refuse, then I certainly, Boaz says, will redeem you. I will marry you. Chai Hashem, I take a solemn oath, and he invokes the name of God. Shichvi ad haboker. Stay with me. Lie down with me until the morning. Now, why is this so crazy? It's crazy on a number of levels, okay? What happens in the morning, as you're going to see, if somebody sees her? It's a problem. If somebody sees Ruth exit the granary, the witness to this, then they say, but wait a minute, Mr. Boaz, all this talk about let's give Tov a chance. You already have a pre-existing relationship. I don't know, maybe there was some hanky-panky going on there in the granary all night long. So it almost disqualifies himself as a judge. He sort of has to recuse himself from the case. Do you hear that? So if that is a worry, as you'll see, it's a real risk. He's worried about this in the next verse or two. Then why not do the simplest thing? You say, Ruth, you lay it out for her. I 100% am in with you. I am privileged, and I'm so honored,
And I feel the same way about you that you do to me. You are exciting. You're everything I would want in my wife. But I can't act until I know whether Tov, who's one step closer to you by law, whether he acts or not. So I have to wait. So on a simple level, I think it's human level, how can you say this to her? She's exposed herself in the most fundamental way. This poor girl, Ruth, might go home, and no matter what his words say, where were his actions? Nothing. It's all promises, right? I mean, she could go home and commit suicide, God forbid. She might be so despondent in her future and so broken and shattered. Here she exposes herself in the most fundamental way, and he just rejects her, even though he gets platitudes. So he's worried. He says, stay, stay. So it's a sign. So she's going to stay 6 hours, 1 inch away from him. And he doesn't touch her or lay hands on her in an inappropriate way. 6 hours. 6 hours. So, well, what's going on? So, I'm glad you asked. This is, according to the mystical book, the Zohar, this mystical Kabbalistic work by the great Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, wrote it in the cave. You learned about this, if you remember, on Shavuot night at my house. In that cave, he wrote this mystical book. And in the Zohar, he treats this Lini Alayla as a metaphor, not for just Boaz and Ruth, but Boaz becomes God. And Ruth becomes, beautifully, the Jewish people. And what is the Lila? What is the night? The exile, the darkness of the Jewish experience with the destruction of the temple. And in the Zohar, it says gorgeously like this, and I'll read the words again in the Hebrew in Yud Gimel, number 13. God says to the Jewish people, Lini Halayla, stay with me the night, stay the night. The fact that you, even after a Holocaust, still put on talis and tefillin and go to shul, oh, I love you. So stay the night. I promise you, the Hayah B'Boker, that there will be a morning, a redemption. You'll be back in Israel. The Mashiach will come. The Im Igalech Tov. And if your toe, if your good deeds that you do, that you accrue, are good enough to bring Mashiach, the Geula, the redemption, then Yigal, then the Mashiach will redeem you. Vim lo yachpotz legalech, but if it doesn't turn out that your merits are enough to redeem you, Gal ticha anochi chai Hashem. God says, I swear in my own name, I will personally get you out of the exile. In other words, if you don't merit Messiah coming, I promise in my own that I will. So this whole, I mean, it's amazing. Okay, you ready to take it more amazing? Let's crank it up. Let's crank it up here. Okay, you ready? I'm going to give you a handout in a minute. And I will attach this for our listeners at home. Let me tell you a little bit about, you can just put your book down for a minute, okay? Because this is something special. Let me tell you a little bit about one of the most tragic people in the Talmud. You may have heard of this man. His name was Elisha Ben Avuya. Elisha Ben Avuya was a Tanaic, a Mishnaic sage in the time of Rabbi Akiva. So we're talking right around the destruction of Second Temple era, okay, Roman Temple. And Elisha Ben Avuya became, tragically, a kofar, a heretic, gave up the faith. No one's 100% clear what happened. There's many, many different things, components that happened. Some say that he saw someone perform the most profound commandments in the Torah. Honor your father. Send the mother bird away. You have a long life and a good life, God says, right in the Bible. And this man died, fell off a ladder and broke his neck. And it shattered him. Others say he saw the tongue of one of the greatest translators, who was one of the 10 martyrs of the Romans, being dragged around by a pig or a dog. And it was so gross, and he thought the tongue is what he used as a translator to say over the Torah, and this is how God rewards the righteous? There's a whole multiplicity of things that might have shattered his faith. Regardless, Elisha ben Avuya changed, and he became a heretic. He gave up his faith. However, his greatest student, who is also, incidentally, a student of the great Rabbi Akiva, was a man you've heard of, Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir was the off-the-charts most brilliant rabbi in all of Israel. His name means to light up the eyes. Because when he would argue, he could take the defense side of an argument or the prosecution side of an argument, and whatever you had at him, he'd win both sides. So it's a problem when it comes to Jewish law, because he's so brilliant, he could win either side of the case. That's a problem. But Rebbe Meir kept learning from Elisha. And there's stories of how Elisha was walking with them, and he was riding on a horse on Shabbat, which is forbidden. And they get outside the area, 2,000 amot, a certain area outside of a civilized, developed area, and Rebbe Meir was not even aware of it because he was so immersed in their dialogue that Elisha stopped and says, you know, you can't go any farther. I can't because I'm riding a horse and I don't care about Shabbat. Rebbe Meir, you can't. And they asked Rebbe Meir, wait a minute, Rebbe Meir, how can you continue to learn Torah from this man? He has heresy in his blood. You don't know. He said, no, it's okay. For you, it's not okay. But for me, it's okay because I'm Rebbe Meir. He says, his Torah is like a pomegranate. He says, the shell and the inedible parts, I know how to identify them because I'm Rabbi Meir, and I throw them away. They have no effect on my soul. But the edible parts, the parts of Torah that I can take from what he teaches me that are holy, that I can continue to consume. So all his life, Rabbi Meir always, always kept his friendship and his closeness with his teacher, with his Rebbe, even after Elisha ben Avuya became known as the moniker Acher, someone else. We only refer to him at that point when he becomes a heretic. We don't call him by name. So if you ever see his name quoted in the Talmud, it's before he got into heresy. Post-heretical views, they only call him the Acher, the other one. So I am now going to share with you a little story which comes from the Jerusalem Talmud. Okay? And this Jerusalem Talmud, of course, was written by Rabbi Yochanan, the great Rabbi Yochanan, the great sage. And it is a full story of the end of the life of Elisha ben Avuya, this tragic man that we call Acher, and something that Rebbe Meir tries to do with him. Okay, all his life, Rebbe Meir keeps learning with him and keeps trying to convince him to show him the error of his ways. But remember, Elisha is so brilliant, even Rebbe Meir can't change his mind. So let's see what happens. Sometime later, Elisha ben Avuya fell ill. And Rebbe Meir was told, your master is ill, your Rebbe, your teacher is ill. So Rebbe Meir went to visit him, and he said to Elisha on his deathbed, do teshuvah, he said, repent. Elisha asked, having gone so far, I mean so far away, that I've done this horrific, horrible, he's accused of doing horrible things with the Romans and other things, not good. He says, have I gone so far? Will my teshuvah, will my repentance be accepted by God? Rebbe Meir replied, is it not written in Tehillim in the book of Psalms that you allow a person to return up to their being crushed? Means to the last second of their life, they could still have the opportunity to repent. Isn't that true? Up to the time that life is being crushed out of them, they could still repent. In that instant, as Elisha was dying, Elisha ben Avuya began to weep, and then he died. Rebbe Meir rejoiced. He said, my master, it would appear, departed in a state of teshuvah, of repentance. But it wasn't so. After he was buried, a fire came forth from heaven and started to burn the grave of Elisha. There was smoke coming out of the grave. So they went and told Rebbe Meir. They said, the grave of your master is on fire. Rebbe Meir went out and he spread his cloak over the grave. Listen to what he said. This is amazing. And he said to him, Lini Halayla, stay the night. Just what we said with Boaz saying to Ruth. He said, stay the night, Elisha. Elisha's dead now. This is his grave. In this world, which is holy night, stay the night. And it shall be Vahayava Boker, and it shall be in the morning. You see all the quotes from Ruth. That the world to come, all of which is considered Boker, morning, that if the one who is good, Tov, Yigal, if he will redeem you, that is the Holy One who is good, of whom, as I said, the Lord is good to all, and God's mercy, Rachamav Kol Ma'asav, and are all of God's works from Psalms. But if God is not willing to redeem you, Elisha, then I, Rabbi Meir, will redeem you. When I die, I'm going to go to the pits of hell and pull you out. As the Lord lives, he says, Shichvi, lie down until the morning. The fire was then extinguished. Wow. So here's Rabbi Meir using exactly, literally quoting from the verse that we just did in Ruth, how God says to us, I'm going to take care of this. Boaz says, Ruth, I'm going to take care of this. It's okay. Stay the night. And if in the morning it doesn't work out, I promise you in the name of God, it's going to be okay. God says this to the Jewish people in a universal promise of the end of the diaspora and the promise of a Messiah and a redemption. And on a very personal, very meaningful level, Elisha ben Avuya, this heretic who was away, is promised by his great Rebbe Meir, I will take care of you personally. I'm going to drag you out of the pits of hell. Who's going to stop me? Rebbe Meir says. No one's going to stop me. After I die and you're not in heaven, I'm going to get you and I'm going to pull you out into the next world. So you see how profound these words of the Lini Halayla are. Okay? Let's carry on. Yes?
What does it mean the fire was then extinguished?
Meaning the fire, the smoke on the grave stopped. The fire that had come from heaven.
But who made that happen?
That was God. So God responded clearly to Rabbi Meir's statement, it's going to be okay. Yes, thank you. Amazing, amazing. Let's carry on. So verse Yodala, number 14. Vatishkav Margalosav HaRaboker. So she, Ruth, remained lying at his feet until the morning. Vatakum, and she gets up. Beterem yakir ish yisraehu, before a person could even identify their friend at that distance, we'll talk about that in a moment. Vayomer al yivada, and then Boaz is concerned. He says, heaven forbid it should not be known. Nobody should know. Ki va'a ha'isha ha'gore, that a woman came to the threshing floor. Stop. Let's go over verse 14, which is very, very profound. Okay? So she stays 6 hours until the morning, which is dangerous, because if somebody sees her leaving, it's all over. That's it. It's done. So we explain why. Vatakam. So she rose up. This is in verse middle of verse 14. Do you see the word biterem? It's misspelled. On the right side, it says biterem with a kuf after it. That means kari. That's how you read it. But it's written defectively with a weird letter vav. That letter vav doesn't belong there. So when we read it, we take it out. Well, what's the Vav? The Vav in Gematria, in Jewish numerology, of course, is
six.
6 hours that they spent together. But what else is the six? We'll see in a second. Before Yakir Ish Israel, before a man could recognize his friend, means you can see whether a person is female or male, yes. But the light of the before the crack of dawn is such that you can recognize a shape, an outline of a human being a male or female, but you can't identify someone you're familiar with. That's weird. Why not just say before you could identify somebody? What is it dependent upon recognition of not so much gender, but an individual's identity? Why is that crucial? And secondly, Vayomer al yivadaki vahaisha. Let it not be known the woman. Well, why doesn't it say Isha, the A woman? I mean, my gosh, you're Boaz. You really want it said that you, the greatest rabbi of the world, had the girl, some girl was with you all night and leaving? Why is it the girl? It's not even translated that way. Okay? Ah, I'm glad you asked. So Haisha can only refer to one person. See, it's not a problem for Boaz, because he's not married, that a woman came. But if it's Ruth, meaning if they can identify that it's Ruth, if it was just identified as a gender, as a woman, that's not an issue. That's why it goes on the ability to recognize your friend. If someone can testify, I saw Ruth the Moabite is leaving Boaz from the middle of the night, that's a problem. If it's just a girl generically, who cares? It can't be the woman, because if it's the woman identified, then they'll get up in court the next day and say, Boaz, how dare you presume to preside over a case? Recuse yourself. You have this prior existing relationship with this woman, Ruth. You spent a whole night with her? What went on exactly, Boaz, huh? So it can't be known that the woman is there. Okay. Next verse. Now we're going to explain the extra vav in a second from Beterem, right? Why is it before? This is really interesting. He does something bizarre. In verse 15, Tesfah, Vayomer, he says, don't go empty-handed. Havi hamitpachat asher laich. He says, hold out the shawl that you are wearing. Ve'echaziva v'tochez ba. He says, hold it out, grasp it. And she held it. Vayamad shish se'orim. So he measures out 6 barley corns. Measures of barley. Vayashad aleha, and he set it on her. Vayavoyer. And he went into the city. She says she went into the city. So the rabbi said, well, maybe he went with her because he was scared that she could get accosted. So he followed her into the city to protect her. But 6 measures of barley. You know how small a barley corn. We're talking like popcorn kernels. Okay? This is like such a beautiful. So the rabbi sometimes said, well, maybe it was more. Okay, but it doesn't seem like more. Okay? We're going to answer it in the next verse or so. Okay, you ready?
Verse 16, Tessain. Vatavo el chamata. Ruth immediately comes to her mother-in-law Naomi, Vatomer mi'at biti. She's been waiting all night. Can you imagine? Naomi's like, oh my gosh, what happened to Ruth all night long? She's been desperate to know. What's going on? She says, who are you, my dear? Are you married? Are you still single? Are you Ruth, Boaz's wife, or not? I want to know. Vataged lo, she told her. Ruth tells Naomi, eight kol asher asah lo ha'ish, everything that the man did for her, everything. Vatomer, and then she goes on to say, by the way, shesh hasarim ha'ela natan li. He gave me these six little pieces of barley. Ki amar, because he said, and then there's the word Eli again, which doesn't appear there, but is read in, because he said to me, because it's not me really, he said it to you, Miss Naomi, Al tavoy rekam el chamoteich. Don't go back to your mother-in-law, rekam, empty-handed. It's for you. He gave the six for you, Naomi. They're for you. What is going on here? Well, I'm glad you asked. Naomi, at the very end of the first parak of chapter 1, she had said something kind of sad and bitter. You remember when the women weren't even talking to her directly, but about how she had lost her grandeur and her money. Hazot Naomi, this is the famous Naomi. Look at her now. She's like an old schlepper, right? And what did she say? Look at verse Chafal of 21. I'll read it to you. So she said, Ani meleya halachti. I left. I was male. I was complete. I was full. I had a husband. I had sons. I had prospects in life. Virei kam heshivani Hashem. God has returned me empty-handed. Boaz sends her six barley corns. And he told Ruth, tell your mother, again, look at verse number 17, right? Al tavoi rekam el chamote. Don't go, there's the same word, rekam, empty-handed back to your mother-in-law. Boaz says, really, you, Naomi, this is how you think in your eyes, that God took you back from the fields of Moab, and you were rekam, you were empty? Really? Here's the six barley corns to show how empty you were. What is he saying to her? That there are six individuals, six magical people, who are going to be represented by those six barley corns, which are represented by the Vav number six in Terem, both. And who are these six individuals? They're going to come with the person who accompanied you that you didn't acknowledge. You said, I'm empty-handed. Really? You had Ruth! You had the most magical person in the world who's going to give birth to King David, to Daniel, Mishael, he goes through six people, ending with Messiah, and they're all going to come from Ruth, the person who you said out loud about God has brought me back empty-handed. You did not recognize that God gave you Ruth, and you came back with Ruth, who's going to give you six magical descendants, including the Messiah and King David, who are going to come from you. So how's that for empty-handed? Do you like that? So that was Boaz's message to Naomi with the six of the barley. Because of themselves, they mean nothing. They're just six of the barley corns. But the representation of the six is a shtoch a little bit of a gentle, you know, admonition, if you will, to Naomi. You thought back in chapter 1 you were empty and nothing? You have the world. Oh my gosh. God's giving you six barley corns, which are what? Nothing. But they're the world. Because they're Ruth. And she's going to give you all these magical descendants are going to come from you, Naomi. Beautiful, beautiful. Let's carry on. So what happens? Vatomer shvibiti. So Naomi says to her daughter-in-law, my daughter, just sit down patiently. Ad asher tedi'in, until you know eich yipol hadavar, how the matter will turn out. Ki lo yishkot ha'ish. Because I promise you, the man Boaz will not rest. He will not be sheket, quiet. Ki im kila hadavar hayom. Until he finishes the matter this day. He's not going to wait 1 minute longer. He's going right now, and he's going to settle with who is the Redeemer, who's going to marry you. And believe me, there will be no dust settling under his feet until he accomplishes this today. So we are now going to carry on in this next parak. Okay, very briefly. So there's a very beautiful chazal. The rabbis say, at this point in time, Boaz had done everything he could. Boaz has played his part. He's ready.
Naomi had played her part perfectly. Ruth has played her part. There is nothing the three of them could do. So God says, you know, I think it's time for me to play my part in the play. So that's what's going to happen here. Just as Naomi said, I promise you, Ruth, just stay because the matter will be to settle today. It's not going to wait. There's not going to be any anxiety. Boaz is taking care of it as we speak. So look at Perek Dalet, Pasuk Aleph, 4th chapter, first verse. So Boaz immediately goes up the next morning to the gate of the city where the Sanhedrin, where his court that he was in charge of sat, where they met, and he sits there. And wouldn't you know it, turn the page, Vihine, and here, behold, coincidentally, Hago'el ha'over asher diber Boaz, the potential redeemer, Tov, whom Boaz had spoken about the night before, just happened to come by at that moment. Vayomer. And so Boaz, still sitting, snaps his fingers and says, Surashva po ploni almoni. Come. Doesn't say please, because he doesn't have to say please. He's the king. Come. Over here. Sit down here, Mr. Ploni almoni, Mr. So-and-so, Mr. Anonymity. And he came over, it says, by Yosar, he came, by Yesha, and he sat down. So the rabbis say, wait a minute. Was it Ploni Almoni? Was it Mr. Anonymous's normal way to go to work, that he would come right by the gate just when he needed him at the second that Boaz sits down? So here the rabbis say something very cute. The Medrash, the oral tradition, says, you know what? Remember God said it's time for me to do my part in the plan? It didn't matter where Ploni Almoni was at that moment. He was there. If God had to drag him from the other side of the world to be where Boaz needed him at that moment, it would have been accomplished. He would have been picked up on the wings of eagles, which just began the fourth chapter, and he would have been brought where Boaz needed him because God was playing his role. Now, remember, we never refer to him by his identity, Tov, Mr. Good, as we'll discuss in a moment. So he sits down next to Boaz. You see the command that Boaz has as a judge. He just snaps his fingers and says, sit, mister. And even though it's his uncle, doesn't matter. He sits. Vayikach! And immediately, Boaz takes, he assembles, Asaran, Hashim, Ezeknei Ha'ir, he assembles 10 men from the elders of the city, 10 rabbis. Vayomer Shvufo Vayeshevu. He says, you guys sit here now. And they all sit. You see the command. I mean, the man just, he's the guy, right? He's the king. Vayomer La Goel. This is verse Gimel, Pasuk 3. So he says to the potential redeemer, he says, you know, I have some news for you. You know, there's a portion of the field that perhaps I own, which is also owned by your brother Elimelech, and meaning his widow Naomi now owes it. Machra Naomi, Hashava Mistemov. And now Naomi's putting it on the marketplace. Naomi, who just now returned from the fields of Moab, she is so in such a state of poverty, yet she has no choice but to sell the field. Va'ani Amarti. And I said, I resolved, Egleh Osnefa Lemor, that I should reveal to you, into your ears, saying, Kinei Neged Yoshim V'Neged Zikne Ami. He says, I want you to buy it in the presence of all who are sitting in presence of the elders of my nation. Im Tigal Ga'al, if you will redeem the field, redeem it. V'im Lo Yigal, if you will not redeem the field that belongs to Naomi, that used to belong to your brother Elimelech, then Hagid Eli, tell me that you don't want it. Ve'edah ki ein zulat chaligli, and I will know. For there is no one else, ki ein zulat chaligli, there's no one else to redeem it, except for you. Va'anoch yacharacha, and I, of course, Boaz, I come after you. I'm second in the pecking order. Va'yomer and Tov, Mr. Ploni Amoni, Mr. Anonymity says, of course, anochi egal, I will redeem the field. Stop. So what's going on here? So there are components of a steyachuzah. There's a law of a field that is a family inheritance, where it is incumbent upon wealthier members of the family that in a time of desperation they have to step up to bat to protect the rights of family land in Israel. Now clearly then, Boaz is saying, look, Elimelech's dead. Part of this field perhaps even belongs to me. We share it. And Naomi's in a desperate situation. She's going to sell it out of the family. You need to ante up and pay for the field, okay? He says, absolutely, I pay for the field. Ooh, okay. How about verse number 5? Pasuk Hey. Vayomer Boaz, and Boaz says, oh, by the way, there's a little more information, Mr. Ploni Almoni. B'yom kenos chased em yanami, but on the day that you purchased the field from Naomi, u'me'es rus ha'moaviyah eshes ha'meis,
And from Ruth, the Moabiah, the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, Kanisa, you have to also purchase her. Lahakim Shema Meis al Nachalaso. You have to perpetuate the name of the deceased on his inheritance. You have to do Levirate marriage because Mahlon, who's part of our family, is dead, and you need to step up. It's not enough that you buy the field. You have to marry Ruth the Moabitess. Now, clearly, it's a stigma. Because even though the law has been reintroduced, it was only just then reintroduced that it's permissible for a Jewish man to marry a convert from the nation of Moab. So this is kind of a loaded opportunity. But if Boaz is telling him this, and the members of the Sanhedrin, who are all privy, they know this was law that was reintroduced already before this transaction is about to take place. So they know it's absolutely Torah Misinai. It's law given to Moses at Sinai, and it is indisputable, irrefutable. It is what it is. Nevertheless, let's see how he responds. Vayomer HaGoel. So the would-be redeemer, Ploni Almoni, says probably the saddest words that he'll ever say. Lo uchal. I'm not able, ligoli, to do it for myself. I can't redeem it myself. Pen ashrit et nachalati. Unless I destroy, here he uses the word imperil, lest I wipe out, I destroy my inheritance, my family. Ga'alachata et ge'ulati. You, Boaz, you do it. You redeem it. Ki lo chaldigo. I'm not able to. So he uses the word li over and over and over again. In fact, if you look at the word in that pasuk, how many times does it say the word to me, my inheritance? Okay, let's just go through. I'll show you very quickly, right? Lo chal, I am not able, ligoli, to redeem it for me. That's twice he said about himself. Penashina rachalati, lest I corrupt, I destroy my inheritance. Galachata et gulati, you redeem my inheritance. Ki lo chal ligol, because I am not able to do it. So you have like five times in a row. What is he worried about? Himself? Oh my gosh, he says out loud. If I marry Ruth, the convert, a Moabitess, and I have children, and that child from Ruth, my children, not only the child that I have with Ruth, but all my family are in jeopardy and peril. People will mock us. They won't talk to us. We'll be shunned. My kids won't get into the great schools to learn. They won't be admitted. They'll say, oh, comes from Moabitess. I can't imperil my future. You do it. You imperil your future. You're a bigger man than me, Boaz. You do it. Now, why this is so amazing, of course, is let's contrast that for a moment with Mrs. Ruth. Ruth was asked by her mother-in-law Naomi, go down. Strip yourself bare, your soul bare. Bare your soul and expose yourself and do all these things with this man, 80-year-old Boaz. What was Ruth's response? I'm in. What word was so antithetical to her motivation that we actually didn't even take, it wasn't even written there. Remember? A lie. It's not about me. If you want me to lose my identity, to ostensibly become you, Naomi, to go down and do things for you, because you need this done, I'm in, 100%. Which is what the Jewish people said at Sinai to God. We're in. What's the opposite of that? I'm concerned. What's going to be with my family? What are people going to say? It'll be a stigma. Oh my gosh, I'm going to have a Moabitess wife. It'll jeopardize everything I've done in my world. You do it. So here's the irony. The woman who could care less about her own identity, to the point where her identity is even taken right out of the Megillah. We don't even worry about it. It's not a problem. This is what you want. You want me to give up my identity for you? It's done. She becomes the Ema Shamachut, the mother of all kings, of Messiah, David, Solomon. The man who's so worried about himself, he loses something. Guess what he loses? His identity is gone! When Samuel writes the book down, he takes away his real name, Tov, and throws it out of the Megillah. Says, you didn't acquire that name. You lost your name. You're so worried about your identity. You're fixated on your inheritance and your future. You'll have no future. You're dead to the world. You have the opportunity to be the father of the kings of Israel and the Messiah, and you blew it. I'm going to take your name on. I'm going to call you a name, Ploni Almoni. You idiot. You're going to be John Doe with a little tag on your toe because you're dead. You gave it all up. You're so fixated on yourself. You're selfish, little man. And so here's this remarkable contrast that the one who is so worried about himself destroys himself.
And the one who had absolutely no need for self or identity becomes Ruth, has the Megillah, has David, has Solomon, has the Messiah. It's a very, very shocking but very profound idea for our own lives. That when we do only out of concern for ourself, not for concern for others, it actually strips ourself away. Because we're not that important at the end of things. But when we do for others, when we put ourselves out there, even if we jeopardize what we think might be a problem, we say, no, I need to take care of this. I need to help you any way I can. Oh, but it's potentially dangerous to your good name. I mean, we're not talking about anything illicit. We're talking about doing good deeds, doing mitzvahs here. You can't do a good deed and jeopardize yourself. That's the whole point. If you're so fixated on your own great name and your legendary status for a time immemorial, you're going to kill your status. It won't work. But if you don't worry about it, you say, I'm just going to do what needs to get done, which is exactly what Ruth said. Boaz wasn't worried about himself. Then it's going to be, that's how you get a pedigree. That's how you live forever. And Ruth lives forever. And poor Toph, his name is jettisoned right from the book. We don't even know who he is. Yes. It's a very powerful idea. So, we're at the end of this class. I will just summarize briefly what's going to happen, and then next year, God willing, we'll do it a little bit more in depth, so you can close your book. I'm just going to tell you clearly what happens. Okay? So, good news. After Ploni Almoni, Mr. John Doe gives up his opportunity to marry Ruth, Boaz says, then I'm stepping up. They get married in front of the great rabbis there. They have a great wedding. And that night, Boaz impregnates Ruth, and that child becomes the servant of God, so much so that they call him Oved, an Eved Hashem, servant of God. And Oved, of course, is the grandfather of Jesse, the father of King David and Solomon, and traces the end of the Megillah, goes through the lineage that takes you from Judah and Peretz, Tamar, all the way down to the Messiah, and traces the Messiah, Mashiach ben David. And it's just an amazing thing. And when the child is born, Naomi miraculously becomes a youth again, a ute. And she is able to actually, miraculously, nurse the little baby. So it becomes like almost like her own baby. And again, Ruth has no problem with this. In fact, they don't even mention Ruth, the last few verses of the Megillah, her own book, because Ruth has sort of given up. Her identity has been subsumed by the baby and by Naomi. And everyone there goes crazy, and they start to praise Naomi. A child has been born to Naomi, and Naomi is brought back to life again. She is redeemed. Her dead son, Mahlon, is redeemed. The child, of course, is like the Gilgal, almost like a reincarnation of the soul of Ruth's dead husband, Mahlon. And that he's redeemed. That's why we said Mechila. He's somehow been forgiven by God for his crime of desertion of Israel. So it comes full circle. This entire wonderful book was there to validate the lineage, the yichus, the genealogy of David. And I think at the end of the day, it really teaches us so much about, again, what it means to be Jewish. From someone who wasn't, someone who chose it at tremendous cost to herself, her own identity. And in the end, as we said, miraculously, she lives a long, long time. She had a special chair right in the room of the kings, and she got to sit next to her great-grandson, King David, and she even saw Solomon while he became the king of Israel. So she lived a really long time as a privilege to her, and the one who was not worried about her future, her legacy, becomes Ruth HaMoabitess, this mother, Imash HaMalchut, the mother of the kings.